It's Friday, October 23rd. Well, that's your one real debate, America. Hope you enjoyed it. We start here. It was structured but salty.
Would you close down the
other way? I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I would transition.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden give their most focused performances yet. What moments might have moved the needle? Passing a relief package before Election Day would be really inconvenient for lawmakers, but people are losing everything now.
The debt just built and built and built.
One business owner tells us why she's done waiting. And two countries have successfully begun to infiltrate voter registration files.
My immediate reaction was just kind of fear.
Walk you through what you should and what you shouldn't be worried about. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Political pundits can argue over which candidate really lost out by having that chaotic first debate a few weeks back, and then who lost out more, perhaps, by skipping the second one. The real loser, of course, though, was the American people.
The audience here in the hall has promised to remain silent. No cheers, boos, or other interruptions, except right now, as we welcome to the stage former Vice President Joe Biden and President Donald J. Trump.
But last night, right on schedule, both candidates arrived in Nashville, Tennessee. The same backdrop as the first debate, the same podium, same spacing. There was even a last-minute decision to go back to a stage without plexiglass barriers. But this time, Kristen Welker was seated in the moderator's chair. And suddenly, finally, American voters got to hear a real back and forth about the next 4 years. So let's break this down quickly. We got ABC's senior national correspondent Terry Moran and ABC's deputy political director Mary Alice Parks. Terry, I'll start with you. Was this just like the same debate as before, but a lower decibel level? Or was there really something to take away here that was different?
I think you're absolutely right, Brad. It was a better debate. It was a real debate. I think it's the best debate Donald Trump has ever had. Joe Biden seemed on his game as well. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that the Trump campaign and conservative media and social media were spending millions of dollars trying to convince the American people that Joe Biden was falling down, losing his mind, senile. And I think that case cannot be made after this debate.
So I'd like to terminate Obamacare, come up with a brand new, beautiful health care.
The problem with the president is what's he running on still. He brags about accomplishments that he may or may not have achieved.
He didn't do anything. He didn't do it. He wants socialized medicine.
He attacks Biden a few days after attacking Fauci, after attacking Leslie Stahl. It is still hard to find the theme in the pudding in the Trump campaign for re-election, even though he really did master his arguments.
And he wants to take away 22 million more people who have it under Obamacare and over 110 million people with pre-existing conditions. And all the people from COVID are going to have pre-existing conditions. What are they going to do?
Joe Biden was much more effective that way. He not only got in his general message, which is that Donald Trump has failed and the country needs a change in character in the presidency.
What I'm going to do is pass Obamacare with a public option. Become Biden care.
But he got a number of his policies in there, too, laid out on health care and on the economy and other things as well. So, yeah, it might have been to draw on points, but for Donald Trump, who's behind in the polls, that's not going to work.
Mary Alice, how did this strike you at first? Because, you know, this was billed as the foreign policy debate, but it's no surprise that a pandemic across the world is going to be front and center.
Right. The pandemic that still changes every bit of how Americans operate every moment of their lives was still the first and central part of this debate.
What happened? What did the president say? He said, don't worry. It's going to go away. Be gone by Easter. Don't worry. The warm weather. Don't worry. Maybe inject bleach. He said he was kidding when he said that, but a lot of people thought it was serious. A whole range of things the president has said. Even today, he thinks we are in control. We're about to lose 200,000 more people.
President Trump.
Look, perhaps just to finish this, I was kidding on that, but just to finish this.
I'm not sure the president really enjoyed that. At one point in this extended back and forth about the coronavirus, the president even said, okay, just to wrap it up here, he seemed very eager to move on because these questions are hard for him.
And you say, I take no responsibility.
Let me talk about your two.
Excuse me, I take full responsibility.
It's not my fault that he came here. It's China's fault. And you know what? It's not Joe's fault that he came here either. It's China's fault. They
kept to Terry's point, he's often more interested in going on the attack than defending his own record, which is still remarkable for someone that's trying to seek a second term.
He says that we're learning to live with it. People are learning to die with it. You folks home will have an empty chair at the kitchen table this morning. That man or wife going to bed tonight and reaching over to try to touch their, out of habit, where their wife or husband was, is gone. Learning to live with it. Come on. We're dying with it.
And look, the president on a few occasions made reference to his own personal battle with the coronavirus, made reference to his family also being diagnosed with the coronavirus, but mostly stuck to his pretty predictable talking points, trying to downplay the health risks from experts, arguing for opening up businesses, and really brushing aside the fact that hundreds of Americans are still dying every day.
It felt like one of the new things here was not, you almost knew what they would say about the coronavirus pandemic. It was interesting that Kristen Welker asked a pretty straightforward question next about Iran and Russia looking to meddle in our election. But both candidates seem to take that as a cue to attack each other's motivations.
Well, that was the invitation for Joe Biden to actually take a step forward and talk about
his buddy, Rudy Giuliani. He's being used as a Russian pawn. He's being fed information that is Russian, that is not true.
And it was Biden who kind of walked into that.
The kind of money that you were raking in, you and your family.
Trump dumped on him, and then Biden, I think, baited a trap and said, I haven't made a dime from foreign money. My tax returns are all out there for my entire adult life.
Go look at them. 22 years of my tax return. You have not released a single solitary year of your tax return. What are you hiding? Why are you unwilling? The foreign countries are paying you a lot. Russia's paying you a lot. China's paying you a lot. And
you're the one with the secret bank account in China. Why don't you show your tax returns? I think he tried to turn it around on Trump. And we went down the rabbit hole.
We have to give 10% to the big man. You're the big man, I think. I don't know. Maybe you're not. But you're the big man, I think.
I don't think that's a fight that Donald Trump, with all of his business entanglements, which he can explain, is going to win against Joe Biden, who he's all of a sudden shifted from Biden as a senile old man who can barely function to he's the mastermind of an international criminal gang. I mean, it's hard to make that stick in a matter of days.
And Joe Biden had pretty effective body language during this point, I thought.
And now we have a steal.
Okay,
image.
Vice President Biden, your response, please.
My response is, look, this isn't about, there's a reason why he's bringing up all this malarkey. There's a reason for it. He doesn't want to talk about the substantive issues. It's not about his family and my family. It's about your family. And your
he has this tendency to, when he's trying to gain his footing again in the debate, to look straight at the camera, to point straight at the camera, to try to talk straight to your living room, your family.
Your kitchen table.
And your kitchen table. And in this in this back and forth about who was possibly more corrupt or who had foreign entanglements, he pivoted and pointed straight at the president, which actually only served to make it more obvious when he pivoted back away and focused back at the camera. The president still struggles with that. The president struggles to talk straight to a family and seemed much more interested in talking straight to Joe Biden.
What other issues stuck out to you? Because you almost knew what was going to be asked near the beginning, and then there were some questions about China and North Korea. It's foreign policy, of course, but they really seem to get fired up on kind of the identity of the U.S. over the next 4 years, particularly when it came to, I don't know, healthcare, infrastructure, even energy. What other issues do you think they thought they were scoring points on?
Immigration, and Mary Alice has been talking about this as well. I thought that was Joe Biden's best moment.
About. What happened? Parents were ripped, their kids were ripped from their arms and separated. And now they cannot find over 500 of sets of those parents, and those kids are alone. Nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. It's criminal.
Biden seems very down to earth about that. I think Americans don't feel great about that.
Let me ask you a follow-up question.
Kristen, they did it. We changed the policy.
Your response
they
to that?
They did it. We changed.
Did not.
They built the cages. Who built the cages, Joe?
Let's talk about
it. And it was also a moment where he distanced himself from President Obama in a way that we just don't often see from Joe Biden. You know, he was asked about about President Obama's record with deportations, why Americans should believe that Joe Biden would be able to do something on immigration when so many candidates have promised that in the past. And he delivered a pretty good line where he said, this time I would be the president, not the vice president.
Did that with criminal justice and race, I believe, too. Like he a couple times he sort of took on Obama himself.
And said that there were mistakes made.
He made a mistake. It took too long to get it right. I'll be president of the United States, not vice president of the United States. And the fact is, I've made it very clear. Within 100 days, I'm going to send to the United States Congress a pathway to citizenship for over 11 million undocumented people. And all of those...
And Brad, I think there was one other moment which jumped out to me, and that was Joe Biden saying that he wants to be the president who puts the oil industry on the path to extinction.
I have one final
would
question.
Would he close down the oil industry?
It falls.
Would you close down the oil industry?
By the way, I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I
that's
transition.
A big statement.
It is a big statement.
And now, he may say it's a long time away and we got to get there, but that is going to really hit home in a lot of parts of the country. It'll hit home with a lot of businesses and a lot of investors. And it will also hit home with young people who want to see progress on a problem they're going to inherit.
Because it has to be replaced by renewable energy over time, over time. And I'd stop giving to the oil industry. I'd stop giving them federal subsidies. He won't give federal subsidies.
But it was a very momentous thing for him to say. And I think Trump, wanted more of that because he thinks that will play to his advantage.
I was going to say, it certainly draws a distinction.
Totally, right? Yeah. Oh, you can imagine the Republicans are already cutting those ads.
That's the biggest statement.
Okay.
Because basically what he's saying is he is going to destroy the oil industry.
Okay.
Will you remember that, Texas? Will you remember that, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma?
Vice President Biden, let me give you 10 seconds to respond,
Ohio.
And then I have to get to the final question.
You can see almost like a glimmer in the president's eye when Joe Biden said that. Yeah, you know, I think that in somewhere like Pennsylvania, sure, it could be a deciding issue. That's true. Somewhere like Texas, look, if Democrats really have Texas in play, then the president
that
is really
already
in
trouble. That is already a problem.
He also mentioned Oklahoma.
Oklahoma,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, all of a sudden,
if he's in trouble in Oklahoma, he's in big trouble.
Yeah, well, so then you might have just answered my question then. Was overall then what Americans take away from? Because I can't imagine there's somebody sitting at home going, wow, that line, now I'm convinced to vote for the other guy. I've just changed my whole worldview. But did either candidate build their case more strongly than they had before? Did they seed that doubt that they were looking to seed?
Well, in my view, there's no question that if you were a Trump voter who had grown disheartened with the chaos, and he's got coronavirus now, and the constant fighting, and you just don't even feel like you want to go vote for him, maybe. I think you've been heartened by the president's performance in this debate. I don't know how much of a difference that's going to make, but he did himself a favor. I still don't think he's presented a vision for where the country's going to go, but if you like Trump and you were kind of saying, ugh, I'm just exhausted by it, and I don't really need to get involved in this one, I think you've got a reason to do so after this debate.
All right, Mary Alice Parks, Terry Moran in Washington. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, there was one issue discussed we have not mentioned yet. That's because we're talking to someone who's actually living the consequences, the price of inaction, after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In many ways, that's a wrap on the arguments revolving around this campaign. I mean, there's still time for surprises, still plenty of time for rallies and speeches, but Americans will not be hanging on every word because pretty much everything is out on the table. What we don't know is exactly how devastating COVID-19 will be over the next few weeks. We know we're seeing a swell in cases that'll likely get worse before it gets better, so you can imagine more people staying home, more businesses shuttering, and there is an open question of whether Congress is going to do anything between now and Election Day to keep people afloat.
Congress rushing to pump another $310 billion into the Paycheck Protection Program designed to help small businesses keep paying their employees.
The last major national economic relief package was passed by Congress in April. It will be 6 months tomorrow. A lot of people got their $1,200, maybe some extra unemployment benefits if they lost their job. And that was that. Well, this past Sunday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went on This Week with George Stephanopoulos with a message. There was now a deadline.
If you don't get that agreement in the 48-hour deadline you said, what happens?
Well, here's the thing. The 48 only relates to if we want to get it done before the election, which we do.
You might have noticed, it's been more than 48 hours. Still nothing has changed. It did seem to prompt the White House to discuss a potential deal with her. That's where you have seen movement this week.
You'll have to compromise. We can't swallow, neither side can swallow poison pills, and we're narrowing those differences.
But there's still no sign that Senate Republicans would even consider a big trillion-dollar stimulus package before the election.
The Democratic argument appears to continue to be, if we can't have everything we won't allow anything to pass.
But make no mistake, every day that ticks by, it is easy to lose track of how urgent this is. For millions of Americans, a deal now versus a deal a couple weeks from now, that is the difference between keeping your job and losing it. It is the difference between keeping your business and closing it. And for some, the inaction so far has already taken its toll. I want to go back to someone we met earlier this year. Natasha David is 35 years old. Several years ago, she gathered enough cash to start her own business, a cocktail bar in Manhattan's Lower East Side. You might remember her talking about starting a woman-owned bar in a sea of bros, becoming profitable this year, and then having to shut it down in March, just trying to hang on. She's back with us now. Natasha, how's it going?
It's going, I think, as probably deep down in my heart, I knew it would be going, which is that my bar is closed.
And you were telling us last time we spoke about how you're just hoping for assistance. You were hoping for something to give, the pandemic to give, something. Take me through the next couple months. Like, how did this play out?
Well, we kept pleading with our landlord to see if he would negotiate the rent at all. I don't know if you remember, but we got lawyers involved, which actually ended up, I am very thankful to my lawyers, but the process actually dragged everything out for an additional 5 weeks, which also means another month of rent. So the debt just built and built and built, and there was going to be no relief, and the government wasn't showing any signs of offering any sort of relief, and we had to call it quits. Not before, though, having to trigger something called a good guy clause, which I think we briefly talked about last time, but it's basically a clause in a lot of commercial leases where if you want to leave your lease early, you have to give your landlord X amount of notice and pay rent up until that point. So besides the back rent that we still owed, we now also owe them an additional 4 months of rent.
Right. And so you shut down the business. You're in debt yourself, right? How much do you owe?
So we paid March rent, obviously, because we were still open and, you know, functioning. So April to December, that's about $95,000.
Wow.
I will say, in some kind of weird sense, I feel a huge sort of sigh of relief. You know, it starts affecting every single part of your life, and you can't stop thinking about it, and you don't sleep, and it starts affecting the way you're behaving around your children. And so in that way, I'm relieved that at least, like, even though it's not the outcome that I wanted, obviously, I'm grateful that I have a decision. On the other hand, I'm completely devastated, right? This is, you know, anybody who opens a small business isn't doing it for, like, a fun little side project. It's your heart, it's your work, it's your life's passion. So to just see it get so disregarded and neglected by the very system that's supposed to be supporting you feels, you know, for lack of a better word, it's very hurtful. And I'm angry. I'm very angry.
According to Yelp September Economic Impact Report, more than 32,000 restaurants have closed their doors since the pandemic began, 61% of them permanently.
Restaurants have a very big ask in terms of they've taken a beating on this, and I think there's bipartisan interest in helping restaurants.
I mean, what is it like to watch these stimulus talks back in Washington? Because you were saying at the time, we need congressional help. The talks were on, they're off, they're on now again, but it must feel like just way too late for you.
I don't understand how people's livelihoods can be something that we are debating this long.
If a presidentially supported bill clears the House, at some point we'll bring it to the floor, yes.
Let's remember that, like, yes, my restaurant, my bar closed, but, like, I lost my employees. But I'm also, like, the linen company that I get my linen from is being affected. The small little wine producer in California, who also probably just had a wildfire, is being affected by the loss of my business, right? So this is a huge trickle down, you know, effect.
We're looking at least a year and a half of staying idle.
It's been very tough. I had to temporarily furlough all my staff.
We kind of do live paycheck to paycheck. We use the whole stimulus check on the house.
The fact that the government is basically, I feel like right now, playing like political chess because this election is coming up feels, I don't know how, it feels so, it's disgusting, really. I mean, it's just, it shows such a lack of care for humans.
What would have helped? What sort of, are there specific things that you were like, this should be in a relief package that would have helped? Like, if they had just passed this thing, I wouldn't be here right now.
I mean, obviously a grant would have been incredible to pay off my rent. But I think above all of that, what really should have happened is that the government should have stepped in and said, cancel rent, cancel mortgage payments. The landlords don't have to pay mortgages. Let's just all be in this together and treat this like the crisis that it is and try to come out of it together as a country and a community. I mean, for me, I'm thinking about the small business and the employees who, you know, are like family to you when you own a small business.
There'll be cars lined up out front to pick up their brunches, but it's really sad to see the chairs piled up and the tables pulled away. And
I'm thinking about all the bars and restaurants that are still open right now and that are struggling.
25% capacity of seating, that which we, it's very good number, but it's still not enough to support everything. I'm still operating at loss.
Kind of like barely keeping their heads above water with their staff, you know, terrified to come to work because their customers are refusing to wear masks. So, you know, they're just...
That's interesting because you're not saying, hey, just let us do what we want. Like, restaurants should just be allowed to do their thing.
Listen, I understand I haven't been out to dinner or to a bar or gotten takeout or anything since March. I miss going to restaurants and bars so much. And I also am so grateful to people who feel like they are able to go and support their local businesses, okay? I think that is great. And I know this is a huge drastic step and it's a big ask, but I really, really, really truly believe that restaurants and bars should be closed right now. I think that the government should step in, take drastic measures, and cancel rent. I think that is the way we get through this, and that we have a stimulus package in place that takes care of the employees. You know, unemployment gets extended. There's extra little boosts. You know, that's how you get through something like this.
If there isn't action from Congress, if the winter comes as we think it's going to with its strength and severity, a lot of folks are not going to be able to fill their houses, and a lot of restaurants are going to have to close for good.
Imagine as a business, as one, these restaurants, you know, they get to open for 2 weeks and then there's a case of COVID, right? They have to close down and lay their employees off again. And like, you know, then, oh, you get to do outdoor dining. Great. But you have to also invest all these thousands of dollars in patio equipment and barriers. And now, oh, it's winter. So now you also have to get, you know, all these heaters, and they follow all these regulations. I mean, you should see the list of regulations for just the kinds of heaters you can use outside, you know, and you have to get inspections and this and that and that, which I understand safety and all that, but it's just like all these burdens are being put on the business owner. And the government isn't taking any of the burden off. It's all getting put on the shoulders of these small businesses that are barely keeping afloat right now. I think that's the most frustrating part, right? Is that literally since the last time we have talked, nothing has changed.
And somewhere out there, there's a couple who's only $20,000 in debt right now, not $90,000 in debt. And they're looking at these moments right now thinking this is their two-month mark, say. All right, Natasha David, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Brad.
And one last thing, real quick, because I know this was brought up at the debate, and you might have seen notifications on your phone. I want to keep you up to speed with this weird case involving Iran, Russia, and accessing voter information.
My immediate reaction was just kind of fear.
I was confused and I was surprised because I have never received anything close to this.
So we knew Iran has been sending emails to pockets of voters claiming to be from the far-right group the Proud Boys, threatening to come after them if they don't vote for Donald Trump. This is a spoof email from Iran. But questions remained, how did they have these people's email addresses? Did they really know those particular voters are Democrats? How expansive is this? Well, government officials have now told ABC News Iran has successfully penetrated voter registration information at certain local elections offices. Russia, they say, has also done the same, which is really worrisome since we don't know exactly how or when the Russians might use it.
Cecilia Lipa got two of the cryptic letters Tuesday. Each one had her full home address.
So what does registration information mean? Well, your local board of elections would likely have your name, what party you're affiliated with, along with your address. They might know which elections you have and haven't voted in. They would likely also have your signature on file. They would not know who you actually voted for. That's important. And it's still unclear exactly which localities and how extensively these countries were even able to infiltrate.
I read that and I immediately knew that it was some sort of scam and that no one was coming after me and that I had already voted.
Iran and Russia have denied any of this. In the meantime, officials say these countries are trying to exacerbate divisions within the U.S. So maybe take a breath before hitting that retweet button. Don't be easily influenced. 11 days to election day. You got this, guys. Remember, if you haven't voted yet, you can check out the handy guide from our friends at 538 who have the rules for every state. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Trevor Hastings, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimbel, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Eric Donson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Terry Lickstein, Rick Green, Kara Fisher, and Micah Cohen. I'm Brad Bilkey. See you Monday.